This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support comes from Brian Lowe Financial. 877-217-5757 is your number for Talk Louisiana. Our email is talk@talklouisiana.org. Matt Doyle producing, and our leadoff guest joining us from San Francisco is Sydney Kohara. She is an LSU graduate, class of 1979. She and I were in school together. She was just a bit ahead of me, but what a career she has had. And 30 years ago tonight, when she was a relatively young newcomer to the Bay Area, she was anchoring the news on the ABC affiliate in San Francisco, and boom, the earthquake of great significance hits the Bay Area, a magnitude 6.9 quake that killed 67 people and caused more than $5 billion in damages. And it happened just as San Francisco and Oakland were playing in the World Series. An unbelievable coincidence. And Sydney Kohara, good morning to you, joining us on the West Coast.
Good morning, Jim. How are you this morning?
Doing well, and I'm sure you recall 30 years ago tonight as vividly as though it were last night.
Woo, I can't believe it's been 30 years, and you're right. I can remember exactly where I was sitting, what I was doing. When I saw my clothes moving in the closet, I was in a San Francisco apartment building, and had just gotten off work from covering a story about the World Series, and I noticed my clothes in my closet start moving, and I was talking to my old boss in Sacramento, which is almost 100 miles away, and all of a sudden, the building, it sounded like an earthquake, a train coming through. And I said, we're having an earthquake, and my boss, 100 miles away, a second later said, I can feel it up here. And it just didn't feel like it stopped for forever. I mean, it was 15 seconds or so, and I said, I've got to go back to work. I looked out the window, and I think a lot of people remember seeing the video of a building in the marina that had collapsed, and that was only about a mile from my house, and I could see on the hill a big mushroom cloud, and I immediately was able to get my car out, got to the station, and we were on for, I think it was, felt like 24 hours, just covering this. Thank goodness with the World Series, we had the coverage. So we had generators, so we were able to come back on when a lot of stations couldn't. And it was just nonstop, and you don't think, you just do your job. You do whatever someone asks you to do. You volunteer. And you just cover it the best way you can. It was, it's pretty, I don't even look at the video because it's really emotional to look at it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Al Michaels was the announcer at the World Series, and it was an ABC presentation, and then the earthquake happens. And as you can imagine, everybody's wondering what the heck is happening here. And they go to the local affiliate, and there is Sydney Kohara just a few months employed at this station, and you were there not only for the Bay Area, but for the entire country, if not the world. It had to be a riveting experience for you to get this kind of exposure, but to do it under these circumstances, what was that experience like?
Jim, it's sort of being in the right place at the right time, at the wrong time, actually, but I actually had only been at the station for 3 weeks. So I was the newest member of the newsroom, and when the earthquake happened, pretty much everyone else was at work because I was anchoring a morning news show, so I was at home. They sent everyone out to cover all the local stories that they could, the Bay Bridge collapsing, the World Series, the Marina District building collapse. So I was in the newsroom, and the news director, Harry Fuller, said, listen, Sydney, you know, I know you don't know the Bay Area that well, but can you just call and find out about bridges and things? So I was doing a lot of work behind the scenes, and he comes over and says, you know, we've got a couple of international stations who just want a live broadcast update, so can you go sit over in the update chair and just do that? I said, fine. And I proceeded to just Japan and Australia and Germany and parts of Europe, and so I was there for about 2 hours just giving all the updates I could, and then they sent it over to Ted Koppel for his show. And you know, I think even though with just 10 years experience, you just sort of you focus so much on what you're doing there and the information you have. And I think what I most remember too about that is I worked in a newsroom. I didn't know a lot of people at the time. People were handing me something to drink. They were handing me information. And I found out later these were the executives in the station who just dropped everything and came over. I mean, it was one of the most incredible times to see a newsroom run like a well-oiled machine. Everybody pitched in. Didn't matter what they were doing. Didn't matter their job. They did whatever they needed to do to get the information out to the people. So it was, I was there. I have to tell you, though, funny story. I was there for about 2 hours until the main anchors, who do the main shows, all of a sudden realized I was getting all the, attention doing the international slots, and I kind of got big-footed pretty quick. But that was fine. It was, I totally understand that's how it works, you know. So it was just an amazing time. But I tell you, it is, I still 30 years, and driving around Union Square in downtown San Francisco, all the lights were out in the city. There were probably 8 inches of glass from the big department stores in the street. It was an eerie sight.
Well, Sydney is a native of Alexandria, and she graduated from LSU's journalism school before it was the Manship School, 10 years before this event. And your first gig was in Montgomery, Alabama, a great news city, the capital of Alabama, and there you are as a newbie, and you're rubbing shoulders with George Wallace. That had to be quite an experience.
I had an opportunity to take a job in Syracuse, New York, or Montgomery, Alabama, and I figured from Montgomery, if I got homesick, I could drive 8 straight hours home to eat gumbo in my mother's kitchen, which I did several times in the middle of the night. I took Montgomery. I was making $135 a week, pretty much doing the same thing I would do in San Francisco and later years, anchoring, reporting. I had a film camera. I would go out, and you know how hot and humid it can be in Alabama as it can be in Louisiana. And I'm out there. I remember the governor stopped a press conference one time because he saw me out the window coming up the steps lugging a film camera and a tripod and some lights, and he stopped and waited for me. So it was that experience. I met George Wallace Jr., and he invited me to my first Thanksgiving away from home with his dad and the family. I thought it was a very gracious gesture. And, one of my first stories was covering the KKK marching again from Selma to Montgomery. There was a hurricane. Just met some wonderful, interesting characters and some lifelong friends. And it was just jump in and learn everything I could and learn on the job. So that was good being in a smaller market like that.
Well, you and I shared some common mentors at the journalism school, one of them being Jules Dimacord. I'm sure he made an impact on your career.
He was such a dynamic instructor. He made stories come alive. I don't know if it's true. Someone told me he worked for the National Enquirer many, many years
ago.
That is
true.
I said, he knows how to tell a story, and he was very memorable. I remember, Dr. Pennybacker? And there were just, I remember, being a, doing the color commentary for LSU games. I don't know how I wrangled my way into being a sports reporter, but it was something I was very interested in. I had always wanted to cover the Olympics, and I was up there doing play-by-play. This was a couple of years before you became the sports director. But LSU was such a, even back then, it was just filled with just wonderful, wonderful instructors. And the first class I took, I got a 0 on my test, and the professor said, some people aren't meant to be journalists. And I remember crying at the Piggly Wiggly into the phone to my mother saying, I don't know if I can do this. And she just encouraged me to keep going. So anyway, that's a good lesson for everyone. Just keep going, keep plowing ahead.
Well, it's worked out well. And you became a market legend in San Francisco, left there and came back. And for those who may not be familiar with Sydney's varied career, at one point you were working for CNBC.
I was. I left San Francisco. When I went to CNBC Asia in Singapore in 1997, at the time it was called Asia Business News. It was like a Spanish language station, say, in San Francisco, but this was an English language station in Singapore, not knowing anyone except one person I had met one time. Who said, oh, come to Singapore. I said, no, I'm going to go to Hong Kong and have a job. But I wound up going to Singapore, which later they merged and it became CNBC Asia. And so I was there for the Hong Kong handover. You know, a lot of it, Jim, is just taking chances with opportunities. Like I said, I knew no one, but I went over and I said, I've got to see the world. Life is short. And when you go to CNBC Asia, it's not uncommon for 20 million, 30 million people to see you a night. So it was just an amazing opportunity and the chance to travel all over Asia, and by myself, too.
There you go. Well, Sydney, it's been a pleasure. Let's do this again soon. You're a fabulous authority on many topics, and it's an honor to share the microphone with a fellow LSU journalism grad, Sydney Kohara, who 30 years ago tonight was on the anchor desk when the earthquake hit San Francisco. We'll be back.
And thank you, Jim.
This is Jim Engster, and we're joined now by Ruta Sepetys, an internationally acclaimed number one New York Times bestselling author of historical fiction. She's been published in over 60 countries and 40 languages. Her latest work is The Fountains of Silence. And good morning to you, Ruta.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And this is Madrid, 1957. I don't even think you were around at that time, but you obviously have a passion for post-World War II Europe, and how did this project come about?
I do have a passion for this time period, but I also have a passion for what I call hidden history, history that slipped through the cracks. And when I was touring for my first novel in Spain, the Spanish readers were so compassionate about the hidden history in that story. This was a story of communism that I had written. And when I asked them about their history, they told me that it was too complex for an outsider to understand. And more importantly, they said it was just too painful. And that really raised my curiosity, because if we don't understand one another's story, how can we understand our motivations? And so that's what inspired me to look into the Spanish Civil War and post-war in Spain.
Well, as mentioned, this was at a time a little over a decade removed from the Second World War, but there was the Spanish Civil War, which many may not be as familiar with, but you know a lot about it.
Well, to be quite honest, I didn't know as much. You know, these dictators, Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, we know the villains' names because we teach the villains' names. But I myself didn't know much about Franco, even though he ruled for 36 years. And when I told people that I was writing a book that was set post-Spanish Civil War in Spain, some people said, oh, I love Spain. I've visited many times. Remind me, who's Franco? And so that really, you know, inspired me to dig a bit deeper.
He was not a nice guy, was he?
No. So during this dictatorship, there was no freedom of religion. There was no freedom of the press, media, radio, newspapers. Everything was censored. Bookstores, you know, publishing companies, textbooks were written by the government. There were no equal rights. A woman was not allowed to have a passport or to open a bank account unless she had special permission. Franco wanted to isolate Spain. He was promoting this certain form of Spanish fascism, you know, Spain first and a pure Spain and noble Spain. And so the train tracks in Spain were purposely a different width to control the flow of entries and exits. But then in the 50s, Spain fell on hard times economically and needed to open up to outsiders. And the country that agreed to do business with Spain was the United States, and that fascinated me, and I had to know why, and I had to put it in the novel.
Well, you have a character, Anna, who is the main character and certainly a big part of this. How does Anna and also Daniel Matheson, how do they weave through Madrid at this time?
Well, because I'm not Spanish, I knew that I was going to have to write this book from the outside in. So I chose a character, Daniel Matheson, the son of a Texas oil man who comes to Spain with his father. His father's doing business with Franco. And in Madrid, he meets Ana, the daughter of Spanish Republican parents who were executed by Franco. And Ana's working at the hotel where Daniel's staying. And together, they embark upon a journey that puts both of their lives in danger. And Daniel's a photographer, so he's seeing this history unfold from behind his lens and gets a photo on film that, you know, puts them in danger.
Well, it was a time in which there was plenty of danger. You quote a U.S. diplomat as saying that when he first went to Spain in 1955, there was a feeling of depression and repression, and it was one of the most dangerous places on the earth, wasn't it?
Yes, and the interesting thing is that although there was so much danger, American tourists were flooding in and out of Spain. And when I spoke to people who had visited during the dictatorship, they admitted that they truly did not know that many people in Spain were suffering in silence. And when I was researching, why was the U.S. over there? What were we doing? I went into the presidential archives, the diplomatic archives, and what I found there was astonishing and exciting. And so what I've done is, as you read through the novel, there are some nonfiction oral history source material that I put in to give the reader an indication of what was going on behind the scenes.
You also note that when Generalissimo Francisco Franco died in 1975, he was hailed as a great leader by none other than President Gerald Ford.
Yes, and this was also fascinating to me, how Franco's legacy throughout his rule changed a bit. That in the beginning he was regarded as a very brutal dictator, and then by the end of his life, he was regarded as a benevolent dictator. And I wanted to examine that a little bit. Why was that? Was that because foreigners were doing business with him at that time? And then when Franco died, the country adopted what's known as the Pact of Forgetting. They felt it was too difficult to prosecute 36 years of alleged offenses, and so they would agree to forget. And I think that contributes to why maybe we don't know more about Spain's history during this time period.
How did the characters of Ana and Daniel Matheson evolve with you?
Oh, well, you know, as a writer of historical fiction, the characters, that's where my creativity comes in. Because you can imagine, I have to stick to settings, you know, dates and places. This is history. That's hard history. So I had to stick to that. Obviously, we're in Madrid. It's 1957. The setting is an American hotel. The very first Hilton Hotel was in Madrid during the dictatorship. So I have my setting, but then my creativity comes in the characters. And how Daniel and Ana evolved, I interviewed over 100 people who had been alive during this time period. They were either family members of victims, they were survivors, they were true witnesses, they were Francoists. And I pulled threads from those people, and so I created these composite characters that are Daniel and Ana.
Well, it's a fascinating ride and a fascinating read, and Ruta is one of the leading people in this craft of historical fiction. Born and raised in Michigan, now living in Nashville. You're a Southerner now.
I am, and I've always been a storyteller, but I haven't always been an author. Prior to writing novels, I spent 22 years in the music business, and that's originally what drew me to Nashville. I was helping songwriters and recording artists tell stories through music.
Well, this is a story about some of history's darkest corners, heart-wrenching novel about identity, unforgettable love, repercussions of war, and the hidden violence of silence, inspired by the true post-war struggles of Spain. The Fountains of Silence and the significance of the title?
Well, during this time period, the people in Spain, they couldn't speak about what happened to them. And then after Franco died, they adopted the Pact of Forgetting, more silence. And when I researched, what really touched me was how this affected the young people. These young people, instead of being able to pursue their hopes and dreams, were forced to become fountains of silence.
I'm old enough to remember, Ruta, when Chevy Chase closed Saturday Night Live by saying Francisco, Generalissimo Francisco Franco is still dead.
And I am old enough to remember that as well.
Well, it was 1975, and this is about 1957 Madrid, The Fountains of Silence from New York Times bestselling author Ruta Sepetys joining us from Music City, and congratulations for another exceptional work. Ruta, you've done it again. Thank you. Coming next on Talk Louisiana, we'll visit with Roslyn Kine, known as Rozzy. She's an accomplished singer and really is an understated performer and happens to be the sister of one Barbara Jones Streisand. Imagine how difficult that is to be a singer and be the sister of Barbara Streisand. Also on Saturday, LSU will not only be closing its season against Texas A&M, but it'll mark the 40-year anniversary of the hiring of Bo Ryan as head football coach at LSU. He only served 42 days as head coach of the Tigers, never coached a game. His plane went down on a flight from Shreveport to Baton Rouge, and Bo Ryan and pilot Louis Binscotter perished in the Atlantic Ocean as the plane went way off course. It's never been totally resolved how that occurred, but Robert Bo Ryan was only 34 years old, and think about it. He was a successful coach with a great background. He might very well be the coach today if this had not happened. He could be the 74-year-old coach. Instead, LSU's had 10 coaches since then. And let's remember Bo Ryan on the 40th anniversary of his hiring, November 30, 1979. Back with more Talk Louisiana after this. This is Jim Inkster, and we're joined now by veteran entertainer Roslyn Kine. She has released a new recording. For the last year, Rozzy has been in the studio working on a new CD. And this is something that many of us will remember. Save the Country is the name of the CD, and it has relevance to a time long gone with Laura Nyro, and that has certainly been an influence in doing this. Tell us about it, Roslyn.
Well, first of all, it's one of the cuts on my new album. I don't know what the title of the album is going to be yet. We're still doing it. So The history behind it is, I mean, I grew up in, you know, the 60s and the 70s during the whole thing with Vietnam and the college kids protesting and everything. This was during a time of the country's unrest. And Laura Nyro wrote this song and she recorded it. And very brilliant, very mark of its time. And I just thought with what's going on in the country and in the world today, it was a perfect time to do something again, to try to bring people together, to bring people's hearts together.
Well, that song was kind of an anthem at the time, and you're bringing it back, and it certainly has stood the test of time. Why do you think it's relevant particularly to today's times?
Because we're going through a lot of unrest. There's been instigated violence, and people are entrusting people. We have a problem with our government not being... You know, I remember happier times. This is a very chaotic time, and I'm sure most everybody is under stress, with unsureties, not knowing where we're headed. I think that people need to come back to themselves and to their hearts and realize that all of us want the same thing. We all would like a nice, happy life, to enjoy life. And I don't think it's in going against your brother. I think everybody has a good heart. You have to come from your heart, though. You've got, and people have to feel acceptance. And I just think that we all have to open our hearts more to unconditional love. I think that's why we're here on Earth. Learn that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've been doing this for a while. Rosalind's a dynamic, multi-talented entertainer. She's had a career in all facets of the industry, from acclaimed recordings to sold-out performances on Broadway. And it all began for you in the great city of New York. Tell us about your odyssey.
My odyssey from what? From babyhood?
I guess from babyhood to where you are now as far as the entertainment aspect. How did it happen for you?
Actually, I come from a musical family.
Yes, we know that.
Okay, so and so music was very profound in our house, and it was very influential in who we are as people. And I know that when I was a little girl growing up and I had a weight problem and I had friends in school and I was a teacher's pet, but I was alone a lot of the time. And I used to live through the music I would play on my phonograph, on my record player, as we called them. And I would, you know, do things that from television shows that I loved and act them out, create scenarios for myself. If there was a show that I would like, I would write myself into this
script and play an imaginary character in an imaginary scene. So I always loved, I guess, performing, and music was the bottom of my soul. And I decided when I was 14, after I had lost a lot of weight, to make an approach into the business, because that's what my love was. That was, I didn't know where I was going to be today with that, but that I just loved the music, and that's where I found my life, the most of my life, my make-believe life, which became my reality. And in high school, I started doing demonstration records for my sister's record company. Not for her record company, her publishing company. So I would be the one that would go into the studio and record a song that a composer submitted if they wanted to represent the song. And I would go into the studio and record the demo that they would send out with a copy of the lyrics to other artists to see if they wanted to do the song. And during those years, I ended up auditioning for different record labels and different, and I was taken by RCA Records, who signed me. I was actually signed by the same guy that signed Elvis Presley to the label many years ago. And so my first day out of high school, my graduation day, as a matter of fact, I was 9 o'clock going down the aisle to Pomp and Circumstance, and 12 noon I was in the recording studio starting my first album. And that's how the beginnings were. And then working towards a show that had to be put together. And I made my actual television, big public debut was on Ed Sullivan after I had done a lot of break-in dates at little places around the Eastern Seaboard.
Well,
go ahead.
You certainly were influenced by your sister, who's about a decade older. And for those unfamiliar, Rosalind's sister is Barbara Streisand. How much of an impact did she have on your formative years?
Well, I love my sister. We were close. She taught me how to dance and do the cha-cha. She taught me we harmonized. You know, when I was a little girl, we harmonized. She taught me how to harmonize. We used to have fun that way. But my sister had already left home at 16. She graduated out of high school early and wanted to start. She always, obviously everybody knows her story. She wanted to be an actress, and so she wanted to get a good start early. And so anyway, the way she did influence me, basically, was because I saw that my sister attained what she wanted. She was on her way to going, and it gave me the impetus to try it myself. Although I came many years later, she was already a big star on Broadway and had done film. And I was also raised in a different type of music. My era was the 60s and the English Invasion. I love the Beatles, you know, Cilla Black and Dusty Springfield and Petula Clark. And my influences were somewhat different, but I also had the traditional influences as well from theater and from listening to my sister, listening to her records, you know. So the fact that she was able to attain what she wanted so much in life gave me the wherewithal to try to do something I loved. And, you go on, you don't really, I ask for opinions when I want it, but, you know, she feels also that it's like she doesn't want to put her stamp on me. I have to be who I am. We're different in a lot of ways. We're similar because our genes are familial.
Right.
But we're also very different. And so, those were my beginnings, and I just went, you know, I made a big debut at the Persian Room in New York after working on an act with Richard Maltby Jr. and David Shire, and we traveled with it, and then I opened on December 17th, 1969 at the Persian Room at the Plaza Hotel. I think I was one of the youngest performers to ever play there.
Yeah, you were 18 at the time, I believe, so.
Yeah, I actually became 19 during my run.
Did you go to the same high school as Barbara?
I only went there for a year, and then we moved to Manhattan. So I actually went to private school for a year, and I didn't love it. So I then went to Julia Richmond, which a lot of celebrities have gone to also, on 67th between 1st and 2nd in New York City. I finished out school there before I started into my career.
And it's been going now for about a half century. Rosalind's done very well on her own, and you have performed some great recordings by the Beatles, by Neil Diamond, who also went to the same high school as Barbara.
Right.
I think a year apart. But who, other than Barbara, who are the others who have had big influences?
Shirley Bassey.
Oh, yes, yes.
I love Bassey. I love her drama. I just love to go for the storyline and push the drama. Because to me, a song is a three-act play. Act one, act two, and act three. It's got a conclusion. And that's why I only pick songs that I really feel, because it has to come from my heart in order to have my audience feel it.
I bet you're great when you do Shirley's Never, Never, Never.
Oh, God, I haven't done that yet, because I haven't done most of her stuff. I remember years ago I did a song called Going, Going, Gone.
Yeah.
Here in Los Angeles at the Backlot, and I love that song. But, you know, I have a mix of things. There's the traditional things I do. I do theatrical things. I do comedy. I do pop. I do a little jazz. I don't like to be pigeonholed, you know, but this is this new album that I'm working on is very much a little new ingredient of where I've stretched musically. And the reason I also got to where I am with these type of these songs that I'm doing is because I have been very made aware on a search that I made for myself back in 1984 when things were up, down, sideways, and I'd been married and divorced and not knowing what was going in my life. And I actually was doing a lot of reading on psychic phenomena and life after death and people that come back and communicate. And I found that fascinating. And I could talk to people about that for hours. Anyway, that led me to be regressed. In 1984, I had a past life regression, which brought me to a life where I, in Lemuria, where I was a boy. I was, like in my 20s or whatever, with a turban and sandals and pantaloons. And I was involved in a duel over the love of my life. And unfortunately, the woman was standing not so far from where the duel was happening, and I accidentally got killed.
Oh, my.
So basically, from that, it was like, here I am coming life after life looking for my love. But in my past life regression, it turned into much more universality than that. When I did a word association connected with the going to that lifetime, and that's the only lifetime I went to. I passed the birth canal. I didn't see that. It just took me straight to this lifetime. Was the words that came up were universal, love, healing, all things that had to do with bringing the world together, world love, world harmony.
On display in Save the Country, which is performed with a large choir, proclaiming the deeper meaning of the song by Laura Nyro, and it transforms this American classic into an urgent global call to action. Rosalind Kind, it has been a pleasure, and congratulations on your continuing success.
Thank you so much, and look out also for the next one I'm releasing this month called Light of Love is when I wrote, and that's about finding our love for ourselves and then each other through loving ourselves and moving forward in life with love in our hearts.
Thank you, Rosalind. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to Talk Louisiana. This is Matt Doyle sitting in for Jim Inkster for this particular segment. And we got a treat for you. It's Shankar Venditam with, he's the host of Hidden Brain, that is. It airs on WRKF here at 3 p.m. on Saturdays. Hidden Brain aims to help curious people understand the world by linking research from psychology and neurobiology with findings from economics, anthropology, and sociology. It aims to answer some big-ticket questions about human nature, to the contradiction behind why we love to snuggle some animals and eat others, to maybe some deeper philosophical questions as well. And Shankar, thanks for coming on the program.
Happy to be here, Matt.
Great. And, you know, one of the interesting things about you that I found is that you started off your academic career in a very different place than you ended it. You began with an engineering degree in your undergrad, and then you moved over to a master's of journalism at Stanford. As someone who just graduated in journalism, that's a significant switch. What inspired that?
Yeah, it was actually very straightforward. I was a terrible engineer, Matt. So, you know, leaving engineering was not a difficult decision for me, but it was also a decision that I think was welcomed by engineering itself. Happy to see me go. But I think, speaking seriously, though, I think this marriage of different aspects, you know, sort of the creative aspect of writing and thinking about journalism, as well as the more rigorous things that you learn in engineering school, this combination has served me in very, very good stead over the years, because in many ways I became a science journalist partly because of my interest in science and my familiarity with the rules of science. And having a background in science has proved really useful as I've pursued a career that's been in some ways more creative than a standard science career.
And where's that love of social sciences come from?
I was a science journalist for many, many years, first at the Philadelphia Inquirer and then at the Washington Post. I was a print journalist for many years. And I covered a broad range of science initially before gravitating in some ways to a more narrow focus on the brain and behavior. And the reason for that was really twofold. One, the questions involving the brain seemed to be the most interesting and the most unanswered questions that were out there. And the second thing, of course, is that everyone is interested in human behavior. We want to know why we do what we do, why other people do what they do. And this marriage of these two fields, which is really where the social sciences live, you know, learning about our minds, learning how our brains work, with understanding ourselves and understanding our place in society, it seemed to me that that's the most fascinating area for any journalist to be looking at.
And looking through a few of your podcast titles here, you've got How Masculinity Creates Lonely Men, Where Does Religion Come From, Nature, Nurture, and Our Evolving Debates About Gender. You certainly don't shy away from controversial topics, do you?
No, in some ways, those topics are, you know, the starting point for many of our episodes. We often start from places that are, you know, people are talking about in the water cooler. But I think our aspiration with Hidden Brain is not just to be controversial or not just to be sensational. Our goal is to draw you in and basically say, you know, these topics that are often hot button topics in the news, they are actually windows into understanding something that's more deep and more profound about ourselves. And if we actually use the news, if you will, as an occasion to learn about ourselves, you not only have a deeper understanding of the news, you also have a deeper understanding of yourself.
And, you know, we teased it a little bit at the beginning, you know, the contradiction behind why we love to, you know, love some animals and why we like to fry others up. And I was wondering if you could kind of just give folks a bit of a teaser of this particular program. Using that story as an example, what basic conclusion were you able to come to with that?
Yeah, so this was work, if I recall correctly, that was done by John Hibbing and others, looking at sort of the paradoxical ways in which we interact with other animals. You know, humans are unique in that they are willing to adopt, you know, other species. They're, you know, we're willing to adopt dogs and cats and mice and rodents and snakes and turn them into pets and basically feed them and care for them and look after them. You really don't see that anywhere else in the animal kingdom. You know, you don't see elephants adopting giraffes or elephants adopting leopards and saying, let me look after you. Humans have this almost indiscriminate capacity to care for other creatures, including other creatures that are not human. And simultaneously, humans have this extraordinary capacity to treat animals with great callousness, to treat animals in ways that essentially treat them as just things, you know, to exploit them, to make them into beasts of burden, and certainly, of course, to kill them and to eat them. And the tension between these two things in some ways was the heart of that episode. How is it the same species that's capable of so much empathy and compassion on the one hand is also capable in some ways of so much ruthlessness and callousness on the other hand? And in some ways, it's a way of understanding ourselves and understanding how the human mind in some ways has great capacities to go in different directions. And we, as Walt Whitman once said, you know, each of us contains multitudes.
And you're someone that's steeped in both hard sciences and what is sometimes kind of derogatively called as the soft sciences. Social sciences occasionally gets that label from folks. As someone who has been on both sides of that scientific question, do you agree with that label that the social science sometimes gets as being maybe softer because it can't provide some of the definitive conclusions that hard sciences get? Or does it really have as much of an equal place in the scientific community as a hard science, say, like, you know, biology?
That's an excellent question, Matt. And actually, I just realized I made an error in my previous answer. The researcher in question was not John Hibbing, but Hal Herzog. But to your question about whether the soft sciences should be called soft sciences or whether they should be harder, I actually think there is some merit in calling them soft sciences because in some ways the answers are more provisional. And in some ways we should expect that the answers will be more provisional. You know, when you fire atoms at a screen and you measure how many protons and, you know, are hitting that screen, you can come up with answers that have an extraordinary degree of precision. And if I do the experiment in Switzerland and I do another experiment in France and a third experiment in Nigeria, I should come up with relatively similar answers when I'm running that experiment. it seems absurd to me that we would expect the same thing from human behavior. It would be like saying, will Nigerians and French people behave exactly the same when you put them in the same situation? And the answer is, of course not. Of course they're going to be different because we're informed by all kinds of different factors, some of which have to do with the biology of our minds, but some of which also have to do with the cultural context in which we find ourselves in, with our histories, with the ways in which we interact with the world. And so in some ways, I think the social sciences are softer in that their results in some ways are more provisional, their results are more circumstantial. In other words, what works in one place might not work in the other place. But that should not be taken to mean that there is no science in them whatsoever. It is true that human behavior is very complex and varies widely, and what works in one context does not always work in another context. But that doesn't mean that human behavior is entirely random. There are patterns to human behavior. There are deep structures to human behavior. And understanding them gives us insight into why people do what they do, even if that means that I'm not able to predict what your next question is going to be.
And right now, there's almost like a ravenous appetite for national political coverage and analysis. I mean, you have people discussing fairly obscure parliamentary maneuvers in daily conversation. Politics has kind of become the predominant form of pop culture. So how has your program managed to continue to stay relevant, and not just relevant, but to continue to gain listeners in this kind of environment?
I mean, in some ways, I think it's a twofold answer to your question. The first thing in some ways is that we take things that are in politics. We don't shy away from politics. We cover things related to politics. But we also try and show that what's happening in the news in some ways is revealing about deeper patterns to who we are. So when we look at news events and we look at political conflict, for example, it's interesting that those political conflicts actually tell us something about who we are at a very deep level. When you look at a presidential inauguration, for example, you can draw parallels between what happens with the presidential inauguration and behavior among groups of gorillas or chimpanzees, and basically say, look, there are deep patterns to this behavior that sort of show how we react to people who are in positions of power, how in some ways we genuflect before them and we bow down before them, but we're also wary of them and we are worried about people having too much power over us. But the second thing that I think that we do that has been very, in some ways, it's been an unintentional choice that we've made, but it's been a wise choice that we've made, is we also give people a respite from the news. We actually tell people, if you come and listen to Hidden Brain, we're going to spend an hour not screaming at you or telling you that your beliefs are wrong or that the other side is full of nonsense, but we're just going to give you insight. You know, I often say that we're a show that is less about heat and more about light. We're in the light business. We're not in the heat business. And our goal really is to reveal people to themselves. And I think part of the reason for the enduring popularity of Hidden Brain, especially in these times, is people come to us because they realize everything in life is not about politics. Everything in life is not about Republican versus Democrat and about the latest goings on in Congress. There are actually remarkably interesting things about us, about human beings, that are worth learning and worth knowing, even as part of our minds need to pay attention to what's happening in the political sphere.
And it looks like we've got time for one more question. So I wanted to ask you this. You know, how do you break down sometimes complicated scientific questions for people who are scientifically illiterate? I mean, you've got a lot of NPR listeners who come from a variety of backgrounds. I'm a theater student and a journalism student. I had science courses in college, but let's just say that I passed them. And I think for a lot of people, that's really the answer for them as well. So what is the secret for breaking through that kind of liberal arts barrier with some of the hard scientific topics that you have?
Well, in some ways, I think we have a bit of an unfair advantage because I think the science topics that we're exploring are fundamentally of basic interest to many people. So it's true that it might be difficult to read and understand a paper that looks at jealousy or envy because you have to understand the lingo and the jargon that scientists use in talking about those things. But all of us are interested in questions related to jealousy or envy because jealousy and envy affects all our lives. So in some ways, I think Hidden Brain has a bit of an unfair advantage in communicating science because the science that we are trying to communicate is inherently interesting to people in ways that other scientific disciplines might not be. But there's also, I think, another part of our secret sauce, I think the people on the Hidden Brain team, certainly including me, have a genuine fascination and interest with the topics that we are exploring. And I think when you hear Hidden Brain, you see our enthusiasm for the topics come through, and that enthusiasm is not manufactured. It's genuine. It's sincere. And I think one one of the great lessons that I've learned about radio in particular is that when you are really genuinely interested in a topic, when you think it's one of the most interesting things to be talking about, something in that comes through in your reporting, comes through in the story, and gets people to say, well, if someone else is this interested in it, let me sit forward and let me listen as well.
Well, Hidden Brain airs on Saturdays at 3 p.m. on WRKF, and you can also catch it in podcast form at npr.org/podcasts. Shankar, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from Brian Lowe Financial.